We're talking about apples today with David Binscotter. He's the founder of the Lost Apple Project and also the author of the new book, Lost Apples, The Search for Rare and Heritage Apples in the Pacific Northwest. David, thanks for speaking with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you.
So your book is published by our local company, Keoki Publishing, but as the title infers, the subject is as big as the whole Northwest, and that's because apples grows so well here in our region. And in fact, apples are the largest fruit crop in Washington, I believe. And Washington itself is the leading or one of the leading U.S. producers of apples.
Yes.
I'm going to throw in a full disclosure here. My day job is at Keoki Companies, the book publisher. But I think a lot of our KRFY listeners will find the topic of interest. And in fact, you visited some orchards locally to help identify if they hold some of these heritage apple trees, and we'll circle back on that in just a minute. But David, let's start at the start. How did you get started as an apple detective, so to speak, tracking down lost and abandoned apple trees?
Well, I'll tell you, it was something that I had no idea I'd ever do. It was something that kind of just appeared out of nowhere, and I knew that the story needed to be told, and I ended up, took almost probably about 7-8 years to actually coming up with enough information and the lost apples rediscovered to want to write a book. And it all started really with a neighbor of mine, a lady that I knew through my church. And she was a victim of polio as a child, but she went on the mission field, and she was able to spend decades out on the mission field. But when she returned home, she had post-polio, which causes a lot of problems for former polio victims. And since I knew her from church, I would go over and do little chores for her. And one day I was over there, it was in the fall, and doing some chores, and she said, "Hey, would you mind going and picking some apples for me?" And I said, "Sure, that'd be great." I knew she had an orchard about 200 yards away from her house there, and the orchard actually was on a very, the water table of the ground was close to the surface, because the house actually had their well on the hill. And so even despite the trees being over 100 years old, they were in pretty good shape. So I grabbed a bucket, I grabbed a ladder, and I headed over to the orchard, and about 10 minutes came back and said, "I can't reach any of the apples. All the trees hadn't been pruned in, well, certainly in 50 years, maybe even more than that." And so I said, "No problem. I know how to prune an apple tree. I've always had at least one apple tree wherever I've lived. And my dad showed me how to prune apple trees. And he actually taught me how to graft different varieties on apple trees." So I said, "You know, I'll come back, and when the trees are dormant in like February, I'll come over and prune your trees, and probably within 2 or 3 years, you'll have lots of apples." And so that's what I did. And I went home that winter, and I was just maybe on a snowy day. And actually, I'm looking outside right now, and there's snow on the ground. It was probably a similar day to today. And I was thinking, you know, I wonder what kind of apples those are, because those aren't going to be any apples that I'm familiar with at the store. So I, just out of curiosity, I called her, and she said, well, she knew that three of the trees, the very top, were yellow transparent, and I knew that variety. It was very early in the summer. It's old Russian variety. And then she called her brother, and he knew that the second row of the orchard, there were like three or four wealthy apples, and the rest of the orchard, they didn't know what was in it. So anyway, I did the crazy idea that I should get on the internet, and oh my goodness, the information I found on the internet was just incredible. I found out everyone knows that Washington grows the most apples in the United States, But all the apples that are commercially grown in Washington State basically are irrigated out of the Columbia River or tributaries to the Columbia River. And where I live, which is right up against Idaho in the eastern part of the state, there's really no commercial apple growing going on. So when I started looking on the internet about apple growing in eastern Washington, I was shocked. And one of the most shocking things was that about 20 miles from where I live, which is just above Spokane, about 20 miles away, there was at one time reported the largest apple orchard in the world. And it was called the Arcadia Orchards, and it was out of Deer Park, Washington. And that just led me on to articles after article about eastern Washington and northern Idaho having a really impressive history of apple growing in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And finally, I just was fascinated by all this history, and I was very interested in a nurseryman who lived in Colfax, Washington, which is Colfax is very close to Pullman, Washington, which is where Washington State University is. And I was interested in an article about him in an old newspaper from the early 1900s. And so I was able to pull up this newspaper on my laptop, and I was reading about the article. I noticed that on the same, I think it was on the same page or in the same edition, there was an article about the state fair. And I thought, oh, that might be interesting. When I was in junior high, I had entered a sunflower in the Whitman County Fair. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, we'll see how they entered apples in the fair. And I started looking at the entries for the winners of prizes in apple growing, and it was like one of these times when a light bulb just turns on over your head, and I was like, boing, and I realized that I was reading something really significant. And what I was reading was that happened to be the Colfax or Whitman County Gazette. I want to say it was about 1907, and they were listing every person who entered an apple cultivar in the fair. Like there were samples of old apples would be like Rome Beauty or Wine Sap or something like that. Well, they would any of those cultivars that was entered in the fair got a prize. So that meant that every apple that was entered in the fair was noted in the records. And I thought, if this happens every year and I read newspapers from the week that had the state or the county fair and those are recorded, all after looking at about maybe 10 years, I'll probably know what all the apples were that these homesteaders were growing. And sure enough, I went through, and I believe the paper published the results on like the third week of September, and the fair was the second week of September. So, and I started writing down names of apples. Some of them I knew, like Rome Beauty or Wine Sap, but some of them I didn't know. And I came back home, and I had a book from my research. I'd purchased a book called Old Southern Apples by Lee Calhoun. And Calhoun had written this book. And although the title of the book was Old Southern Apples, most of the apples were actually planted in the North and the South. And so when he wrote his book, he wrote it in two parts. The first half of the book was apples that were old Southern apples that were grown in the South and are still in existence today. But the last half of the book were Southern apples that have been grown in the South, but they were considered lost or extinct. And So I started comparing the names from the county fair with those apples in Lee Calhoun's book. And what do you know? There was like three or four apples in that extinct section that were grown here in eastern Washington. And it was just...
Which means they might still be around.
Exactly, exactly. And I realized I'm the only person who knows this, and it kind of tugged at me for a while, and I thought, you know, I'm going to see if I can find one of these apples, because one of the apples, it was called a Wallbridge, and it was very popular, and although it was considered by Lee Calhoun to be an extinct apple, a lot of people in Whitman County, Washington, had entered it in the county fair. I believe there were six different individuals in the early 1900s that listed it in the county, that entered it in the county fair. And I had made contact already with some apple identification experts who were near Portland, Oregon. And these experts would go to county fairs and fall festivals and things like that, and they would take a table and they'd sit down, and people knew they were going to come back every year, and they'd bring apples to them and they'd see if they could identify apples. Anyway, so I knew these folks, and I asked them, hey, if I send you some samples of what I believe are the Wallbridge apples, would you be willing to look at them? And they said, sure. And so I went out and I drove a lot around Colfax, Washington, found several apples that I felt looked like the Wallbridge. Another reason why I chose the Wallbridge was because it was unique looking. It was not just a plain red apple or a plain yellow apple. It was one of the names for the Wallbridge, a lesser known name, was the Edgar Red Streak. So the apple was red, but it had really crimson stripes on the side. I thought, well, you know, that gives me something to look for. And I was fortunate that the United States Department of Agriculture back in the late 1800s and early 1900s had contracted with some watercolor artists to draw paintings of apples and nuts. And there just so happened to be, I think there were like five different paintings of Wallbridge that were on the internet that the USDA had uploaded that anybody could pull off the internet and look at. So I felt maybe I have a chance of finding this Wallbridge. Driving around Colfax, I saw a couple apple trees, and it's important to note that Colfax, there's some old pictures of Colfax, and there were apple orchards right almost within the city limits of Colfax, and outside of Colfax there were more than 100 farmers that also grew part of their farm as apple trees, and they would in the fall take their apples to the railroad station, and somebody with a company that purchased apples would buy their apples and then send them back east. So, and it was just kind of another way for these farmers to make a little bit of cash in the fall. And the railroads were the main source of transportation in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and apples had an excellent, they produced a lot of income for not a lot of work back then. And so I started around Colfax. Then I took the names of the people that had entered the apple in the county fair, and I was able to find some of the locations where those apple trees were. Most of them were now wheat fields, and I wasn't able to find a wall bridge apple,
Hmm.
but I found some possible wall bridges, and I put them in bags, in Ziploc bags, and sent them away to my experts. But just before I sent them away, I was driving through Colfax, and I looked, and there was an apple tree that was dangling apples over a public water pump station. And they were the weirdest apples I'd ever seen. And I drove up and parked there by the water pump and went over, and I picked some of these apples, and they were apples. I remember calling them apples with corners. They had ridges on them, and they were unlike any apple I'd ever seen. Most apples I've ever seen have been nice and round or nice and conical looking, but smooth skin. These had very distinct ridges, and it was a beautiful orangish yellow apple. And so I stuck it in there, and I said, well, you know, here's another apple. It just, you know, struck my fancy, and if you take a look at it too. Well, it wasn't too long, maybe a couple of weeks, and I received a phone call back from the apple identification experts, and they said, first of all, those five bags of apples that you thought might be the Wallbridge are not the Wallbridge. Well, that was a little bit disappointing. But they said, the other apple is a fall genting. And my reaction to that was, what the heck is a fall genting? And so I then went to the books that I had, the Lee Calhoun book. I went through some other books. And then I started calling all the orchards I could around the country, and all the apple. There were some apple hunters who were out there actively searching for apples. And it turned out that the fall genting was the first lost apple recovery here in eastern Washington. And from then on, I kind of admit I got the bug and started looking for other apples. The next year we found the Nero apple near Steptoe Butte State Park in eastern Washington. And a short time after that, I approached the Whitman County Historical Society and asked them if we could be a project under the Historical Society, and they accepted us as a nonprofit project under their umbrella, and it's been wonderful. We haven't found a lost apple every year, but we've found as many as 10 years in a year, and we've had continuing success, and today we have around 30 apples that were once considered lost that have been rediscovered.
Mm-hmm. And that's the Lost Apple Project, and you're active with a small group, right?
Yes. We're a small group. We have about 10 people in eastern Washington, about 10 people in southern Idaho, and one person down in Oregon, and one person near Seattle.
And these are folks that are kind of like you. They're out
looking
for these abandoned or old homesteads or even commercial orchards that might have some of these rare varieties.
Yes, that's very true. And we found the homesteads are the most profitable for us. The commercial orchards, and it was fun to research all the commercial apple growing in eastern Washington, but we found that the commercial orchards did not really help us find lost apples, because back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, these orchards were growing the popular varieties at the time, and if you grew an apple that was really not grown for commercial purposes, you couldn't sell it. So, and all the commercial varieties, like the Winesap, Rome Beauty, the Wagner, some other apples, Macintosh that were sold back east, those have never been lost. They have always always found their way to heritage nurseries, and they've never become lost.
Yeah, they were just more popular to start with.
Yeah.
So in the process of doing this book with you, one of the most amazing things I learned was that there were a huge number of different varieties of apples in the United States, particularly into the 1800s, into the early 1900s. And in fact, indications are there were more than 17,000 different varieties, which is an astounding number to me. But where did the first apples come from to get over here? They're not native to our continent.
No, they're not. The only apples that are native to North America are crab apples. And so when the very first pilgrims landed, what they brought with them were apple seeds. And at the time, Europe was being ravaged about every 20 or 30 years by the plague. And especially in places like London, places like that, you knew you couldn't drink the water, couldn't go down to the whatever the London River was and scoop out some water because people, all their sewage went into the rivers. If someone died of the plague, their bodies were thrown into the river, their mattress and all their clothing was flung into the river. The river was just basically a sewage line. Now, people didn't understand at that time about bacteria, but they did understand that they couldn't drink the water. And as a result, hard cider became the main drink that these people drank. And even small children were given watered-down hard cider.
Now, we know it has alcohol in it.
Exactly.
To
we know today
disease.
That the alcohol kills bacteria. At that time, they didn't understand that. All they knew was if you drink hard cider, you didn't get sick. If you drank the water, you got sick. So this was it. And it was a massive culture of hard cider drinking. Well, once the pilgrims and the other European peoples that came over and immigrated into the United States, they brought that custom with them. Even though we had sparkling, clear streams and rivers, they brought that custom, and really for the first 200 years, from the early 1600s through to the early 1800s, hard cider making was extremely important to people on the East Coast, and even into the Ohio Valley and down into Arkansas and Alabama and those places. Once about 1800, just about the time that Lewis and Clark made their trip to the Northwest, people were taking a second look at that custom, and the temperance movement was starting to kind of catch on. And so by the time people started moving west in the early 1800s, they weren't really interested in starting hard cider orchards. They were more interested in the food that and drink that the apples could make, and all fruits, the food and whatever those apples could make to feed the family, and then of course even rotten food could be fed to the animals that they were raising. So and apples were so important. Apples were really the only fruit that you could pick off a tree in October and store it in your cellar. And if you had a few Ben Davis apple trees, you could go to that cellar in April and sometimes even May and eat a fresh apple, because that apple had such incredible keeping qualities. And other apples, I mentioned before, the yellow transparent, that was a Russian apple that was brought into the United States in the early 1800s, and people quickly found out that was the earliest ripening apple. You could have apples as early as the middle of July, with so fresh fruit in early July or mid-July, and then there were other apples that were great over the August, September. Some of those were wonderful for drying. Some of them were noted for being great canning apples. Of course, you could make apple cider vinegar from those. And so it just had so many benefits and so much food that people could eat year-round that it was just an incredibly important tree to have plenty of in your orchard.
Mm-hmm. One figure historically, kind of mythological, I guess you could say, is a man named John Chapman, who became known as Johnny Appleseed, because in the early 1800s, it's hard to separate a myth from reality, I suppose, but he went around much of the eastern U.S. at that time and planted trees, right?
Yes, that's true. He, both in the late 1700s and early 1800s, is when Johnny Appleseed was active. So he was still going to cider mills. And in the late 1700s, cider mills were still operating. And he would go and he would grab thousands of apple seeds and go and either he'd buy a piece of land or maybe rent a little plot from someone and put a lot of brush around these seedlings that he would just plant the apple seeds, and he'd grow these. And now if people wanted to grow cider trees, they would just leave them and they wouldn't graft anything to them. But if somebody wanted we'll go back to a Rome Beauty or possibly a wine sap or a Macintosh, then the only way to assure that you get that variety or cultivar is to graft it to the seedling that came out of the ground. Apples don't grow true to their seed, so Honeycrisp apples do not produce Honeycrisp seeds. They actually produce a 100% genetically different tree for every seed they produce. So for every Fuji apple, every Honeycrisp apple you eat in a store, that tree that produced that had to be grafted.
Yeah, that's kind of an amazing fact, isn't it?
It is.
That all that, you know, kind of personal handwork goes into each tree to produce these different varieties, or as you called it, they're also called cultivars,
yeah,
these different varieties. So East Coast, Eastern U.S. was really taken off with tons of apples all around. And how'd they get here to the Northwest? I mean, we have an awful lot of apple trees here now.
Well, you know, the very first pioneers that came west brought apple trees, and they actually brought nurseries with them. A fellow by the name of Henderson Llewellyn, he, when the Oregon Trail opened up, within just a couple of years, he and his whole family came west, and they brought with them three wagons, and one of the wagons, the only thing that was in the wagon was nursery stock. And he had, of course, water the nursery stock every night where they rested, and they made it all the way on Oregon Trail out to Portland, and then went down a little bit south of Portland. And he began the first nursery in that valley. And later, a fellow by the name of Ransom Clark, as soon as Eastern Washington opened up to homeowners, or excuse me, homesteaders, he came immediately. And the same year that basically Walla Walla started, this fellow, his name was Ransom Clark, started a nursery there, and it just goes on and on. That was one of the first citizens of Colfax, Washington, which was a pretty significant day, or excuse me, a pretty significant town back in the early 1870s. One of the first people in Colfax was a nurseryman. So we were dealing with people that really wanted. These pioneer nurserymen were so important because people wanted to know what they were planting and how it could benefit them. And these nursermen, the pioneer nursermen, could tell these people, you want to grow these varieties, this is going to be a great apple for keeping, the Ben Davis. This one is going to be great for drying. This other one is going to be great because it comes early. And they were, the early pioneers were relying on these nurserymen to basically get them through the years that they were there.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with David Binscotter, and he's the author of the new book, Lost Apples, The Search for Rare and Heritage Apples in the Pacific Northwest. And David is also founder of the Lost Apple Project, which is figures heavily in the book. And we're going to run out of time before we know it, Dave, but let's talk a little bit about researching the book. There's a lot of historical research about the early orchards and homesteads in it, but it's also a story about the detective work to track down trees that might have some of these lost cultivars. And then there are the steps required to identify the particular apples that you may find out there in the wild, if you will. You know, tell us what it took to put together this book.
Well, you know, there were a lot of resources, especially in Eastern Washington, and especially in Whitman County, Washington, the records would just keep leading to other resources also. Today, the way we identify these lost varieties are we have done a lot of research on what apple trees were grown out here. We have records from Washington State University. Washington State University was as an agricultural college when it was first born in the early 1890s. And apple growing was a huge part of the university at that time. And we have records from there. We have records of nurserymen. I've got many nurseries. I have lists of trees that they sold. The newspaper, I mentioned the newspaper accounts. So we have really a lot of records that tell us what varieties were grown here in Eastern Washington. And I think that we finally ended up with a number of about 1,600 different varieties were grown in Eastern Washington. And today what we do to identify these apples is we still use the old-fashioned way, which is we get leads to where apples are. We go out, we make sure that they're a 100-year-old apple. We try to find out a little bit about the property, that maybe it was first a homestead here, and then maybe there's a newer house there now. But get that, establish the beginnings of the apple, when they were planted. We send them to the apple identification experts. And if the apple identification experts think this could possibly be a lost variety, our next step is to do a DNA test on that apple to make sure it's not an apple that we already know about. And Washington State University has over 3,000 profiles of apple DNA, and so the apples are then compared against that profile so that we don't recognize a rediscovery of a lost apple when the apple has already been identified.
Yeah, so it's actually quite a process. And one thing in the book that really stands out, I think, for a lot of people that look at it, are the illustrations. And you had mentioned earlier that the USDA Pomological Society has this amazing archive of apple illustrations. Then they are these beautiful watercolors that were painted. But how did this archive come to be?
You know, the USDA, they contracted with these watercolor artists, and then the USDA basically just had the them in their collection for years and years and years. And I believe it was around 2010, could have been a little bit earlier, but they started to take these watercolors and do a super scan of them. So each scan of these watercolors is just as crystal crisp as if it's just you're looking at it right in front of you. And it's really important, not only the beauty of the apple itself, but there's a lot of information that's noted on the apple. For example, apples that some of the apples that we have found originated in Eastern Washington, and they never made it out of Eastern Washington. I'll give you a couple of examples. An apple called Almoda. There's another one called Steptoe. And those apples never became popular outside of Eastern Washington. But luckily, the USDA had, someone had sent them apples from Eastern Washington. They noted the name of the person who had sent it. So we could go out to that property and see if the apple still existed. We have yet to find one of those still existing, but the year that it was sent, and all sorts of good information on that. So we would know even more about the apple than just visually looking at it.
Mm-hmm. People actually can find those illustrations online.
Yes, they can.
Because there's many more than we could squeeze into the book, and they are really beautiful.
Yes,
although I think there's more than 50 of them in the book. Well, we're going to run out of time. I did want to mention that locally, our newspapers, the Reader and the Daily Bee, about a month ago, they carried a story about your work in the book and the Lost Apple Project. And as described in that newspaper story, you had recently made a visit out to an old orchard on the Stan Myers property in Hope here.
Yes.
So when you're out, you know, looking, you get a tip a property owner says, hey, you know, what do you think that might these be some of our lost apples? What happens next?
Well, if the orchard is within driving distance, we'll head out to the orchard, get the owner. It's usually the owner of the property that contacts us and tells us, we've got these 100-year-old trees, and we'd like to identify them. And speaking of the Hope Orchard, yeah, that's exactly what I said. I said, yeah, I'd love to come. Turned out to be a very old orchard, and there were some varieties that I'd never seen before. And there were actually, and our apple identification experts, they had never seen a couple of these apples before. And that's a very good sign when you're going through an orchard and as many as we've gone through, and some apples really throw you a curveball. And so we'll be working on those apples for probably a year or two to try to identify them. And what I do is I go through an orchard. I do a little map of the orchard. I give GPS coordinates to every tree. And that way, if, for example, the trees are easy to identify in the fall because they have apples, they're full of apples. I know which are the yellow ones, which are the red ones. But if I need to go back and get grafting wood in, say, February, all those apples are off the tree, and every tree looks alike. So those GPS coordinates come in very handy, and we can go to those trees, and we'll take grafting wood and then graft them to our trees, and that's especially helpful in places where maybe the trees are away from a house or away from an area they can be irrigated, and some of the apples don't grow to much size, and we really need to get them close to their normal size in order to identify them. And that's how we love to go to old orchards, and that's how we find apples. People call us or email me and let me know the location of these old trees, and that's how we get our find our lost apples. People send leads to us.
Mm-hmm. So if we have any listeners out there that have a mystery, an old apple tree, you can get a hold of the Lost Apple Project at, probably the best way is there's a Facebook page,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It's the Lost Apple Project. It's actually the project of the Whitman County Historical Society.
It is. You can go to the Whitman County Historical Society, and but there, probably the best way to get hold of us would be through the Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, your book, David, Lost Apples, The Search for Rare and Heritage Apples in the Pacific Northwest, is available at the local bookstores. And I got to say, it's just me and my interest in apples, but it's a fascinating read, David. How many years do you think you devoted just to pulling the book together?
Oh, probably at least eight years.
It shows up in the research done there. Well, David, we're about the end of our time. Anything else you might like to let people know about?
No, I hope to hear from many listeners.
Okay, folks, we're on the hunt to save some of these old varieties or cultivars that might be out there. Again, David Binscotter, thanks a lot for speaking with us, and maybe we'll circle back again in some months and see how things are going.
Great, thank you.